Hello again, everybody. Welcome to another exciting edition of the Big Red Bus. I'm thrilled to bring you this conversation with one of the true all-star writers covering the Chicago Bulls today, Joel Lorenzi. Joel is a great writer, born and raised on the west side of Chicago, and I genuinely appreciated the time he gave me. We covered a wide range of topics, and I think he brings a uniquely valuable perspective. After covering Oklahoma City, which is the epicenter of organizational excellence right now, he's seen firsthand what a fully aligned, forward-thinking franchise looks like. Also in this episode, we get into his background. We talk about the potential AD rumors, his time covering OKC, and so much more. Part two will be even more Bulls-centric. That should be coming out on Friday or Saturday. Joel is an all-star writer and even a better guy, and I really hope you enjoy this episode. Most importantly, happy Thanksgiving to you and your families and to all the loyal listeners of the Big Red Bus. If you get a minute, check out some of the music I posted under C Red Fred on platforms, Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube Music, and Amazon Music. Should be able to find it there. Or go to my Twitter handle and click on the link to get to it. It includes Bulls parodies, the Big Red Bus theme song, all marked with the See Red Fred logo. Anything else you find there is one of my original tracks, many of which were fairly popular with my band until we came to an untimely end at the hands of Little People Wrestlers. True story, we'll get into some other time. Anyhow, happy Thanksgiving to you all, and part two should be up this Friday or Saturday. Go Bulls.
Bulls are out of timeouts. 2 seconds left. Giddy for the win!
Through the city where the legends play, Chi-town vibes on a sunny day. Big red bus with the seats in line, talking Bulls all day, we stay on the grind.
Rolling down the lane in the big red bus, see Red Fred and Doug bring the Bulls to discuss. From the Jordan days to the present fuss, it's gold in the convo, so ride with us.
Hello again, everybody. Welcome to another exciting edition of the Big Red Bus as we take the glorious monstrosity out onto the streets of Chicago on a glorious November afternoon in Chicago. I look to my right and lo behold, it's Joel Lorenzi, the fantastic new beat writer for The Athletic. How you doing, Joel?
I'm good, Fred. I appreciate you having me, man. Seriously.
Oh, welcome to the Big Red Bus. I got to tell you, I first time heard your voice was at the end of the first, I think it might have been at the actual media day. And it was, I can't remember the nature of the question, but I didn't recognize that voice since I do listen to press conferences religiously, especially with Billy Donovan. And I'm like, man, that was a good question. Who is that guy? I didn't know it. Reached out to the GOAT and Joe Colley. Like, who is that guy? And you're the new guy there. I'm so excited to have you on the Big Red Bus.
I appreciate that, man. And I imagine that's still a common reaction. The post-game avails are not as readily available from where I sit as they were when I was in OKC. They posted everything on YouTube. It was actually, frankly, annoying. But I am trying to get out there, and I would hope people, that all you can hope for is that you're asking questions that, perk people's ears up, right? And so I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, and we are blessed in this city to have, I think, the best group of beat writers, in the country. I don't think it's close, so.
I think so too, actually.
Yeah, you're a great addition to that group, and, I love reading your stuff. So let's get started. People probably aren't aware of this, but you grew up on the west side of Chicago. Tell us, the listeners, a little bit about your story and share a bit about growing up on the west side and whether or not you grew up as a Bulls fan.
I love the way you prompted that because we talked a little bit before we started recording. You know for a fact I did not grow up a Bulls fan, but you said it. I grew up on the west side. My mother still lives over there. We lived in this house on the west side of Humble Park. All my life, that house is the only thing I've sort of ever known until I moved back, and now I'm kind of southwest, but grew up on the west side and went to Whitney Young around the times. Really, I think the last time Chicago basketball was good, I was a freshman when Jahlil Okafor was a senior and the city was popping. Jabari Parker was still around. Jahlil Okafor, Cliff Alexander. My grade, actually, Javon Freeman Liberty was the grade below me. Taylor Horton Tucker, Dio, obviously, like, we had all these dudes in the city. It was a great time to be sort of getting into basketball in a city that, you know, obviously, like, New York and all these places are sort of, the story of basketball is told through their lens. But as far as a city and the interest of basketball being sort of centralized and concentrated, I don't think there's a better city in the world than Chicago. So.
Amen. Long history of great high school basketball. So you went to Whitney Young, great school. Then let's talk a little bit about after that. How did you end up as the beat writer for OKC?
Oh, and I should mention this because you did ask it. I don't want to be off the hook here. I did grow up a Lakers fan. I was a Kobe guy. My first finals that I vividly remember was the 08 finals.
Disappointing.
So I'm a Kobe guy.
Yeah. Disappointing for you, right? That was when the Celtics win?
Yeah, that was a Celtics win, yeah. For sure. But it wasn't disappointing for long. So.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I will state, I think the worst performance I've ever seen from a great player was in the, I thought it was a 2010. Did they beat against the Celtics, or was it 2009 where Kobe won 6 for 20?
Well, 08 was when Boston won. 2010 was when they beat the Celtics, and 09 was when Lakers beat Orlando.
When did they win the title where Kobe had a terrible game 7? What year was that one? Do you remember that? I thought it was 2000.
Well, 2010. 2010. I think people argued that his game 7 was bad. That was the one that Ron Artest.
Yes.
One with the Same. Shot with like 50 seconds left or whatever it was. So.
And Gasol was incredible. Exactly.
Yes.
I ironically watched that in French Lick, Indiana, home of Larry Bird. I was at a work function and was watching that at a casino in French Lick. I remember thinking,
that's awesome.
That is the worst game I've ever seen from a player at that level, but it was like completely forgotten. Because
yeah, that's deep lore. French Lick as the location, that's deep lore.
Indeed.
And I hope if your memory serves you correctly, one of the worst, maybe the worst I've ever seen from a superstar came the next summer when LeBron went to bed against Dallas. So
no doubt. I bring this up in every conversation. Michael Jordan was ready to win. The difference between Michael and LeBron, Michael was ready to win titles in year two. His teammates weren't. LeBron, his teammates were ready to win titles in 2011. LeBron wasn't. That's
let's not go down this path because I am a LeBron defender, which might give me some hate from listeners here. I will say LeBron was ready to take some scrubs to the echelon like way too early, dude. Like
sure.
He was,
oh yeah.
There's those teams he dragged to the finals and the teams he's had to play against throughout his career are like, it's inexplicable the things this dude has faced. So we'll save that for another episode.
Okay.
I will play the LeBron defender. But to answer your question after that, from Whitney Young, I went to University of Missouri, Mizzou. I was telling somebody this the other day, maybe Jason Quicks, but I kind of just picked Mizzou because they were giving up the most bread. Like I didn't even know that they had this sort of historical J school and this long Wikipedia list of alums. It worked out that way, but I was just, you know, I just didn't want to go to U of I because, at Whitney Young, my graduating class is probably like 600 people, maybe more than that. And like 300 of them went to Illinois. I'm like, dude, I don't want to do high school again. Like I want to kind of see the world, which was part of maybe what set me down this path. I don't know, but went to Mizzou. I didn't start writing. Weird to say now, but I kind of wanted to be like a Stephen A type. I think that was my early inspiration. I'm like, dude, for somebody to trust this guy to go on TV and spew his takes, which were way less wicked to me back then and rooted in different things, that was encouraging for me. And the big thing, if you were around people who kind of spent time around Stephen A, they were like, well, you know, he was the 21st African-American columnist in the country. Like, that was history behind that, and it was admirable. So I think that was kind of what started me down the path. I didn't start writing till my senior year at Mizzou, crazy enough. And my inspo then was like Brian Windhorst, who I've, you know, developed a relationship with since. Like, I just thought he did the job so well and, was really good on TV. And then since then, like, my inspo is like Marcus Thompson. Like, it went from me wanting to be, I think initially, like, selfishly, I wanted to be around basketball and find a way to be around basketball and watch the game for free. And now in a few years since, it's evolved into like a real craftsmanship for me, like wanting to really be the conduit between fans and the team and humanize athletes. and tell their stories. And I think Marcus Thompson is like the greatest on earth at that. One of my favorite, probably my favorite writer. And he was a big reason why I ended up at the Athletic, actually. So I describe myself as a storyteller. I think beat writers have different lanes, and why I agree with the idea that we have the best beat in the country is because we offer so many different lanes and mediums to consume the Bulls. And I like to think that I'm the guy that's going to profile them and really unravel some human layers. At least that's the goal. While also, you know, chronicling the sort of story of this team and many others.
Everything I agreed with there, especially Stephen A, who I'm a huge fan of. I think he's an incredibly deep thinker and always entertaining. And
yeah, he's a bit much good now, but yes, historically, yes.
I love him. I will always be a fan of him. And then I cannot, as a U of I grad, I cannot say that was a great decision to go to Missouri, but that said, it still worked out for you. And I got to ask, so you won the 2023 Rising Star Award, USBWA Rising Star Award. What did that recognition mean to you at the early stage of your career?
Yeah, it was cool. And I remember the call and everything. It was an unknown number, which comes from West Side of Chicago. I don't really answer those because you always think it's a bill collector or whoever. But I remember the call and thinking, like, you know, like, why me? It gave me perspective, because I thought nobody was watching. Like, that was, they gave me the award my one season I covered Creighton. That was my first job out of college. Mm-hmm. I was 22 or 23 when I got that job. And Creighton actually had their best season in program history that year. They had all these NBA players. Who are just starting to blossom now. I mean, Ryan Kalkbrenner, Ryan Nembhard, which is Little Nembhard, Arthur Kaluma, Trey Alexander, Baylor Shireman, like, these dudes are in the NBA now.
Yeah.
And I remember writing about the team, like, damn, this team is special. The Creighton community kind of welcomed me with open arms. But I was thinking, like, this is my bubble here. Like, everything I know is in Nebraska right now. Like, are people even reading me? Are people getting past this paywall for the Omaha World Herald? Which is obviously always a point of contention. People complain about the New York Times paywall, which is fine. I get it, but it is how we get paid. Anyway,
right.
I was looking like, is anybody even reading me? You know? And then I got the call and it was validating and it was gratifying. I'm like, you know, okay, you gotta commit to what you do and you'd really be surprised with who's watching. Like when I covered the Thunder and, you know, obviously like, Our unit of measurement is like Twitter followers, I guess, and like Twitter motion. And, you know, I thought like, like I'm getting some type of traction through this run, but it didn't really feel like I had no clue who was reading me until people would come up to me during the playoff run and be like, oh, I enjoy your work, this sort of thing. So, it gave me perspective and it was validation for me as somebody who, that was my first job out of college, man. Like I wasn't even sure if I could do this, if I could really barrel down the path I have now. And, you know, I guess 3 years later, maybe like I'm covering the NBA for the Athletic. So it's pretty cool.
What's the most important thing you've learned about the NBA reporting that you didn't know before you entered the business?
This is a good question. I think everybody sort of has to pick their spots and who they're going to be as a reporter. This is not to say that you won't work toward being well-rounded, but some people find it easier to communicate with front office execs. Some people are locker room people. Some people, you know, have quirky, you know, some people like are cleaning their glass geniuses. Like everybody has their sort of style and communicates with certain people better. And I think like I'm someone who I want to communicate with everybody. You know, I don't want to leave any stone unturned. So it's been something for me to kind of, I struggle with understanding that doesn't come all at once. And you have to learn how to, you know, if all I've ever been around is players, you have to learn how to talk to execs. But these are all people at the end of the day. And so it's been easy for me to lean on human interaction, which I don't think is so comfortable for everybody. You know, some people are not great at human interaction, frankly. So it's been learning the human aspect of all this. And, you know, cause I think the idea of the job when you're coming up is that, you know, you ask the coach why he isn't fired yet. You detail the box score in your story. Like it is so more nuanced than that. And it's definitely harder to do the job than the 80s and 90s and before that, just because access is like nowhere close. Like, I know people are probably rolling their eyes hearing this, but like, the access is not what it was. You read a Jack McCallum book or even a Jack McCallum story, you're like, dude, they let him follow this team around. They let him be in the locker room. They let him eat breakfast with Michael Jordan at a hotel. Like, what? Like, and so the access is not the same. So we really have to fit into crevices that I'm not even sure I knew the sort of lengths I'd have to go to, as a reporter, but it's cool, man. And that's what makes it all feel real. And I don't even know that that was a definitive answer to your question, but it was kind of the spiraling thoughts I had in my mind.
Well said. I am fascinated about the Oklahoma City Thunder, and I can't think of a better person to talk to about that team than you, since before joining The Athletic, you spent two seasons covering the Thunder for the Oklahoman.
Yeah.
And obviously there's a lot of ties between the organization, that organization and ours, with the Giddey trade for Caruso. And the fact that Dave Kaplan, I don't know if you know Dave, he's a legend here in Chicago, but he reported that the Bulls almost hired Sam Presti after Gar Paxson were let go. In fact, that was probably their first choice, and it didn't happen for whatever reason. But I'd like to get a little bit into that experience for you. What's the one thing about covering OKC that surprised you, either about the team, the city, or the organization?
Yeah, a lot, honestly. I think there's so little out there about the way the Thunder operates, just because they are, relative to the league and to sports, they are an infant organization, man. I mean, last year when they won the championship was their 17th year of existence. Like, that is nothing compared to the Yankees of the world, even the Bulls of the world, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so Sam, I think this is part of why Sam is maybe like the most prized commodity, arguably he's one of the most prized commodities in sports right now. The mind he has, and just the way he's curated this sort of ecosystem and environment. I mean, dude, like I always find it fascinating how different organizations are ran. Some places have the owner like doing media scrums and trying to have his hands on everything and blah, blah, blah. Like I think of, you know, like Matt Ishbia is one who's like, he's having scrums. He seems to want to grab the wheel of whatever they have going on. Other places are putting, you know, maybe the coach has a bigger voice in the organization. Sam Presti is literally the Pope, the governor, the mayor of OKC, really of Oklahoma. He has control of everything, and that ownership kind of just gave him the keys, like, here, do what you need. And I think it's reflected in the way they operate, and the way Sam wants to operate is, I thought it was a fascinating experience for somebody who got hired at 24 to cover them. If that's the only place you sort of know, then you think that's kind of how every NBA team operates, but it's not. They actually operate in a class of their own, not just on the basketball side, but, sort of the way they sort of facilitate relationships, let's say, with players and media, and the relationship with media and players. I mean, it's pretty well documented. This was before my time, but like, there was a Grantland story that Brian Curtis ran back during the Russ KD era, that sort of spoke to this barrier between Russ specifically, but media and players. And I don't know that hasn't completely evaporated in OKC. I mean, part of why OKC and for what it's worth, they don't have a beat like the Bulls, right? Like, they don't have all these traveling writers and reporters and stuff like that. I was the only traveling reporter covering the Thunder, which was a shock in itself. But it was kind of like, you know, I was the only one who they kind of saw as, I guess, I don't even want to say that. I was the only person they saw on the road. So it was kind of like, this was their template. If you're a 24 or 23 year old, which is basically their entire team, I was kind of the template of their idea. Like, the Chicago players have Cali and KC and me as like the idea of what a reporter should look like and who and how to interact with, versus OKC. That was kind of all they had. And I honestly wish I could have developed some closer relationships with some of the guys out there, but it was kind of, you know, the way things work was, you know, somebody would be kind of eavesdropping on conversations when you would talk to a guy off the record. It was kind of that sort of thing. So they were really intentional. And honestly, I mean, I can't blame them. They won a championship. Like, who's going to tell them otherwise now? But they were really intentional about the sort of divide they kept between players and us. And so I kind of thought, you know, being in OKC, I thought that was what it was like everywhere. And Chicago's been pretty laid back. Obviously, they're competing for different things, but it's been way laid back. And I guess the last thing I say about OKC to kind of give you perspective and, you know, kind of wrap all this up, if people are listening, like, what does all that matter? OKC was the only team up until this season, which conveniently became a thing when I left. Up until this season, they were the only team who didn't allow reporters in the home locker room after the game.
Oh my
God. Yeah, and it was something that I was never really happy with. And it's not like, you know, like people are, again, there are probably people listening like, what do you want to see guys get dressed for? And it's like, well, we don't. You kind of just want to, I don't even know that I always needed access to these guys on record in the locker room. Locker room was kind of like just to see how they interacted with each other. And, you know, there are great stories. I remember James Edwards at my place who covers the Knicks. One of his first stories on the beat was Karl-Anthony Towns came into the locker room listening to MF Doom, a very niche but famous New York rapper who has since passed. And he kind of got to talk to Cat about being so New York and his New Yorkian identity and whatever. And that was born in the locker room, being around them in a more relaxed setting, which is kind of all we ever wanted in OKC, relaxed settings to kind of get to know people. And it just didn't always work out that way. There were less opportunities there. And so I kind of thought that was what the NBA was like. And lo and behold, it just isn't, man.
Very interesting. So contrast Acme, Arturas, with Presti. What is their biggest similarity and their biggest difference?
The biggest difference is probably the result of their decisions, right? I do think off rip, the Thunder, the way they use the G League team is much different. I mean, their whole thing has been, obviously Sam had an understanding of, a really good understanding of the CBA when it came into effect and knew the draft picks were gonna matter. And so he's made a thing of not just hoarding picks, but using them to kind of bring in guys and throw darts at the board. Like, who can fit this system best? And who can we help mold? And who can we help develop? I mean, develop is a word they really take to heart out there. I mean, you're seeing it with AJ Mitchell, the way he started the season out there. That dude was, they traded into the second round for this guy, and they might not have needed to go as high as they did, but they did. And they got a guy who's like Tony Parker light and could probably start for all these playoff teams right now. And they just have him. He's just in the fold. So the amount of chances I'd say that they've given themselves to throw darts at the board and draft guys who maybe could not just develop, but be part of this really super deep system is the big difference for me. Obviously, like, these guys, nobody's trading for as many picks as OKC is, but the Bulls certainly have not. And I don't think they've used their G League team exactly like a farm system. I mean, you see it this year, like, Noah Senge probably should be down there more. He's actually down there as we speak, but he should be down there more if he's not going to play with the big team, though, you know, being around the big team certainly matters. You have to strike that balance. But they just use the teams differently. Like, OKC is the best at using the G League team for what they want, which I think is the template everybody should use. And then, of course, like, the business that Sam has done, like, nobody's seen better results with their team building and whatnot. Like, I'll cut AK a little more slack. Like, the template seems to be real. I do still believe in the template of this team. And, you know, I don't know how long it'll take to be a real force, but the template seems real. And obviously asset management hasn't been their best thing. And that is maybe Sam's best thing. So there's obvious differences there. Like, nobody's comparing AK to Sam Presti. But I do think, they've done decent things here. Like, it's pretty unfair to compare anybody to Sam in sports right now. So I don't even know that I'll try to liking them. What I will say is, AK seems to know how to delegate. And I do think, like I said, that there was a, whatever his reasons were down to the very detail, like there was a belief in Josh Giddey when no one sort of believed in him. And I think he deserves ultimate credit for that because they built a team around Josh and sort of made him this guy that definitely can be an all-star. And so I think there is some vision to, I do disagree with his idea that, you know, NBA teams are trending toward 9, 10 good players, whatever. As far as like sustainable and deep success, like it has to be better than that. You can't, like nobody's calling Tyrese Halliburton, which is obviously they want to be in the image of the Patriots. Nobody's calling Tyrese Halliburton good. Like Tyrese Halliburton's good is not TJ McConnell's good. Tyrese Halliburton's great. And TJ McConnell, sure, is good. So you still need great players, which Josh Giddey looks like he can be one of them. But you probably need a guy better than Josh Giddey. So we'll see how much time is left for this to play out. I see a lot of people mocking Anthony Davis to the Bulls, and I hate that. But I do think AK, he has done some good despite, you know, the way people want to drop the entire globe on him, you know? So
Joel, quick question. So you hate the mocking, or do you hate the idea of AD coming to the Bulls?
I hate the idea of AD coming to the Bulls. I think he's a broken player, man. Like, I don't know how people, like, honestly, the way we view the league, like, I'd almost forgotten about LeBron there for the first few weeks. I thought the league was refreshing, sort of, without LeBron. Not to say it shouldn't be with that it should be without him, but things are refreshing, not worrying about LeBron every turn there for a few weeks. And I say that to say that, you know, like, as much as we still think about Kawhi and AD, like, it's okay to just let these guys roam off into the sunset. I have done that with AD. I think if there was some package that was reasonable, I guess I could convince myself to be okay with that for the Bulls. But, like, he is a broken player, and he's never really, as far as like being a reporter, he's never really sounded pleasant to be around. So like, yeah. I don't care that people are mocking him to Chicago, and for as much as people want to build around youth and stuff, like, it seems very backwards to me. I don't know. I haven't thought about AD as a superstar in a couple years now. So
yeah, but Joel, like, one thing I think, so, you know, Joe Colley always talks about the Bulls need to have that guy, and I think you can start to allude to this. And my point is, Josh Giddey's 23. He's on a, now, I think we can all agree, he looks like he's on an all-star trajectory based on his play at the end of last year. And
you're saying, you're alluding to the timeline should be around him, is what you're thinking.
I'm saying more that I think our window now has been set for 4 years because of this contract. Like, I think he's good enough that if you did bring in a player of, what's the problem with the Bulls? To me, the problem with the Bulls is their interior defense is an abomination, and you can't get over that. And is there a player in the NBA who's of that high of a quality as a 32-year-old AD? He's not on the same timeline, true. But to me, our timeline now is 4 years. We have an all-star player at $25 million a year, which is role player money. And Kobe White, I think, you know, I think he's that guy. I've been saying this for a while, like,
that's interesting.
I really think he's that good. He was that good in March. He was the best player in Eastern Conference, and we've all kind of forgot about him a little bit because of his injury. But look at these two games he's played.
Yeah, he's been great.
He's been great. So okay. Go ahead. I'd love your thoughts on
it. I'll say this. You are absolutely right. The rim protection is the worst thing they have going for them, and it is the reason they will kind of continue to be closer to the middle than be a real force in the East to me. Rim protection is the perfect word, abomination. But Anthony Davis has not been the cure for that in a few years. Like, this is not to say that he's not still one of Earth's better defenders, but he is not the world-breaking, scheme-deciding defender that he once was. And that's when he even exists. That's when he's on the floor. Right. And so, like, you know, like, obviously, like, regular, as far as regular season goes, if he was to play, great drop rig, great shot blocker. But, like, Chet Holmgren is a guy I think of as, like, a world-breaking rim protector. Wemby, obviously. Evan Mobley. Those guys don't just fall off trees, so it's almost like a moot point bringing them up. But I do think, you know, like, and we can debate about this for hours about how the Bulls position themselves in the draft. I think if you are looking through the lens of this four-year window, which is Josh Giddey's contract, which is fair, he's going to get paid more after this.
Yeah.
I do think you have to consider, like, could there be a better option, maybe not next summer, but in 2 years, two summers from now, to either draft or really land, probably more likely land, an actual young rim protector who can kind of dictate your team defense. Because my problem, like, I think the Okoro addition is fine if he's, like, lower down the totem pole as a defender. But, like, nobody's, why OKC, and I'm going to stop bringing OKC up after this, I promise. Why OKC is such a great defense is all those guys could probably, in some way or another, be the best defender on a top 12 to 15 defense anywhere they went. Like, Caruso anchored defense here for a while. Jalen Williams is one of the best two-way players in the league and maybe the most switchable, among the most switchable guys in the NBA right now. Chet Holmgren is a defense himself. Hartenstein is a good rim protector, but you probably need another big next step. And then, like, Lou Dort. Like, I don't have to talk about Lou Dort, do I? And so, Okoro's fine as an addition if you have other guys next to him that makes sense. Otherwise, he's going to be left out to dry and bleed very often. And so I think they need a guy that makes sense as an anchor. And again, those guys don't fall off trees. From what I understand, talking to people who are actual draft guys, I am not. That archetype is not exactly coming down the pipeline.
I agree. Next year. That's the issue though, Joel, is like, well, so first of all, let's take a step back on Okoro, but I did want to touch about on him. Like, I love Okoro because, like, last year we had nobody as a, I think, an elite point of attack defender, and you will find quotes all, you know, across the league from coaches who think he is, and we can debate whether he is or not, but there's no doubt he's the best defender to me on the Bulls in terms of on the perimeter, and like, who's going to guard the best guy on the other team? I love it when he guards lower, like when he guards point guards and shooting guards. They put him
right.
You know,
I think that's Ventura. When he's best. When you're putting him on Lowry and all this stuff.
Oh, and Ventura, it's insane. I mean, he's 6'5", 225. But that said, you know, like, now they finally have a guy. All right, that's going to help there. But the issue is you're exactly hitting on the point. Those guys are impossible to find. They're too hard to find, especially where we're going to be drafting. So like, I kind of feel like this is a worthwhile gamble if. I want to keep Vooch at the center position. Then you kind of like replicate a little bit what goes on in Denver, where you're really good interior defenders at the four and for the Bulls with AD.
Okay, that's more interesting. That's interesting for sure. But then again, AD, Aaron Gordon, we might be underrating Aaron Gordon here. Aaron Gordon, AD's still better than Aaron Gordon. But Aaron Gordon is an elite athlete who, if you're asking him to close out and do all this crazy stuff that it's sort of demanded of you when you play next to Jokic. I don't know how much of this you want to ask of AD, not just in a regular season, but in a playoff setting. Like, I know he doesn't even like playing at the five. So like, there are so many nuances to this conversation.
Yeah.
But I just think like, you're right. We're opening up a can of worms that we don't even want to talk about when thinking of the pipeline of big like that. But to me, it's about the conversation of what are your standards? And what are you sort of fixing them to be? And when you say, okay, well, let's go in this package, and a lot of these packages, you know, you've seen them. A lot of the mock packages include Kobe White, which is ridiculous.
Agreed.
And I'm not sure that there's a conversation Dallas wants to have, which this is on them, that doesn't include Kobe White. Like, fine. If that's how to do business, like, I can't necessarily be mad at them. But then it makes me think, like, why are people, to what end do people want to adjust their standards? And what would they say then when AD plays 15 games in a regular season? You know, like, it's about standards to me.
I agree. Joel, everything you're saying I agree with, but I will say this. I don't think Dallas is going to get a better offer from anyone than the Bulls sending their Portland protected pick, a number one, and we can protect the top five. And then two of these expirings, you take your pick, whether it's Herter or Zach Collins. You know, they got those contracts that are like $20 million expirings.
Yeah.
You want P. Will, you can throw him in. Or Noah Essengate. Well, that is a little bit more of a difficult discussion at that point because he is a young player. But if that's what it takes, that's what it takes. You still got everything you need then. I just think that team, I'm looking at the East, I'm like, none of these teams scare me. None of these teams are that much better than the Bulls.
And I don't disagree. Like, I don't know if they'll get a better package. I haven't had time to sort of survey what everybody's assets are and who had the best Dallas package. But I agree. And I know, I can see how you'd look at the East and be like, you know, but also, Andy's going to be back in the conversation next year. Boston's going to be back in the conversation next year. It still comes to me about fairness because if AD does become your best player, and AD led team, as the, it's about standards. Like, what do people want out of the Bulls right now? Do they want them to be fun and a 4 seed/3 seed and maybe win a playoff series? Probably win a playoff series with AD and, maybe two. Like, what are people's standards is what it becomes. I'm more of the, obviously I spent time on OKC, so I'm more of the time, like, Sam Presti's a great motivational speaker, by the way. This dude, again, probably why he's the mayor out there. But he always used to say, we want it to not be an appearance, but an arrival. I think the Bulls should want to arrive to the postseason. And I'm of the thinking that Anthony Davis, while I think you are cooking somewhat here, I think you're almost bound to just appear in the postseason with AD. And if you're looking through the lens of the young core, Kobe, Josh, whoever might come along in the next few years, I think they'll kind of be weighed down in appearances and not arrivals. To me, just because of everything that comes with AD and you look at this, the stars that are in the East carrying other teams. But I think this deserves its own episode.
I agree.
I'll come on a later date for this.